You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Greetings. This is from my book, The Crash of 2016, which is going to be coming out in officially November. They'll be shipping it in October, and it's available now for pre-order. But I just wanted to share a couple of things that I wrote in there, because I think they're apropos of what's going on right now with Syria and the economic situation in the world. One of the main, the essential thesis, one of the main through stories in the crash of 2016 is that the old, I think it was Santayana who said, you know, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it, whoever it was, in any case. That when the last person, as Toynbee is quoted as saying, Arnold Toynbee, when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable. Now, to a certain extent, John Kerry is putting a lie to that because he remembers the horrors of the last great war, although I would say Vietnam was not the last great war. That was probably World War II. And by great, I don't mean in a positive, you know, salute the flag way. I mean, you know, massive. But there are these cycles. There are these 80-year cycles. 80 years ago, we had the economic crash of 1929, really 27 to 34, followed by World War II, which arguably ran from roughly 1938 when Hitler started accumulating his forces. 39, he invaded Poland. I think it was in late 38 he annexed the Sudetenland to Austria. But that was not quite so much considered an act of war as his invasion of Poland in 39. But in any case, you know, followed in the next generation by the Great War, World War II. 80 years before that, you had a series of economic crashes that started very aggressively happening in the 1840s, peaking with the nationwide panic in 1857. And the story I tell in the crash of 2016 is the story of how Abraham Lincoln had just gotten paid and took his check from the railroad. He was a railroad lawyer at the time, took his check from the railroad to the bank and said, "I would like this in cash, please." And it was a good thing he did, because virtually all, a week later, virtually all the banks in Illinois had failed and took their depositors' cash with them. Lincoln had his cash in his pocket. That crash of the 1840s was followed, or the 1850s rather, was followed by the Civil War. This was 80 years before World War II, roughly. 80 years before that, we had the economic crisis of the late 1760s, early 1770s, that led England in 1773. Their revenue was so way, way down in the tank because there was an economic crisis going on both in Europe and in North America. You know, these are the cycles of capitalism. That they passed a series of laws, some to raise revenue, the Stamp Act, some to stimulate the business of the biggest British corporation, the Tea Act of 1773. The Townshend Acts of 1772-1773 were designed to increase revenue. The Tea Act was a tax cut for the East India Company because virtually every member of Parliament was a stockholder in the East India Company. And this so infuriated the colonists that the Boston Tea Party happened in the winter of the early winter of, I think it was November, it might have been December of 1773, and this was the turning point for Thomas Jefferson and for a whole lot of his compatriots, which led to the Boston Massacre. Well, it led to the Boston Ports Act, where the British government said, "You got to pay us back for this $1 million worth of tea," and the city of Boston said, "You know, put it where the whatever," and this led to the Boston Massacre and to the shot heard around the world and right to the American Revolution. So we have these, every 80 years, an economic crisis followed by a war. And what I warn about in the book, in my book, The Crash of 2016, is that we are in that economic crisis. And I started writing this book a year and a half ago, and I've talked about this on the air many times. This is not something that I'm just, you know, those of you who have been listening for years know that I've been sort of writing this book, you know, musing about it on the air, at least the economic crash part of it. And, but in the book, I point out that those crashes are always followed by wars. And this is something I think that we have to be very, very careful about. Now, this is back in 1933, March 19th, 1933, Anne O'Hare McCormick, young reporter, one of the first female reporters for the New York Times, the first to win a Pulitzer Prize for reporting, by the way, 1921. Actually, it was 31 that she won the Pulitzer, and 21 she started. She was the first to chronicle. She went over to Italy, and she chronicled the rise of Benito Mussolini. She saw this firsthand, won a Pulitzer Prize for it. She wrote a full-page, front-page New York Times article. It wasn't front-page, a full-page article, the first section of the New York Times, March 19, 1933, about FDR's election. The headline was, "The Nation Renews Its Faith. Out of the swift succession of events that has marked 2 weeks of the New Deal, this fact stands out that the confidence of the people in government has been reestablished." It had long headlines back then. "Most of all," she wrote about Franklin Roosevelt, and I'm reading this from The Crash of 2016, "most of all, Roosevelt is an instrument of history. His first 2 weeks were more than a transfer of authority from one party to another. It was a change of government instead of a change of administration. One suspects," she wrote, "that he expresses the kind of revolution that fires the American mind, 100% American revolution, whose manifesto is the Constitution. One reason for the present meekness in both houses is that every member is practically buried under avalanches of telegrams and letters from constituents. These messages come to Democrats and Republicans alike, sometimes profane, always imperative. They are mostly variations of a single order. Support the president, give him anything he wants." Now, this is 1933. It was the day after the swearing in of Franklin Roosevelt for his first term as president. The war was not really even on the distant horizon. But FDR said, "Today, my friends, we have won against the most dangerous of our foes. We have conquered fear. But I cannot, with candor, tell you that all is well with the world. Clouds of suspicion, tides of ill will and intolerance gathered darkly in many places." Here in America, we are waging a great and successful war. It is a war for the survival of democracy. We are fighting to save a precious form of government for ourselves and for the world. And he goes on through, you know, the how the economic royalists rose up. And then, of course, the road to war. And the chapter title in my book, The Crash of 2016, is titled "The Road to War, Yesterday and Today." And this is what John Maynard Keynes wrote. Well, I'll get into that in a little bit. But anyhow, the point is, I have been wondering, ever since I first wrote this in the first draft a year and a half ago, what's going to be the war that follows the crash? And I am very concerned that this thing in the Middle East, Syria, could be it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This has all the players. The two largest nuclear players in the world, the United States and Russia. It's got the big players in the Middle East. It's got the world is involved in this. So John Maynard Keynes, he was talking about, and here's where I see some real parallels, okay? After World War I, we had the Treaty of Versailles. And the Treaty of Versailles just terribly punished the Germans. It said, okay, you guys, you know, we had World War One, and you guys did a lot of damage to a lot of countries, and you have to pay us back because you lost. And you have to pay us back what would today be trillions of dollars, and you have to do it quickly. And this is one of the reasons why Germany went into a hyperinflationary mode, because they had to pay it back in German marks rather than in gold. And so they said, okay, fine, we owe you a trillion marks. It's going to take a trillion marks to buy a loaf of bread. Here's a loaf of bread. I mean, that's a condensed version of the German hyperinflation. But in the process, that hyperinflation just devastated Germany, and the Germans were humiliated and devastated and economic, and this all in the midst of the Great Depression. And Hitler comes along and says, I will lead us out of this. And the Germans said, cool. Now, I would argue that that Treaty of Versailles punishment of Germany during World War II is not that different from the way that we are treating right now Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, basically throwing the region into economic chaos, which is what the Treaty of Versailles did, enforced by the threat of military action. And by the way, following the military action in World War One. So here's what John Maynard Keynes said about this. He said the treaty includes no provision for the economic rehabilitation of Europe. This is, again, post-World War One. This is before World War II. We're talking 1933 here. The danger confronting us, John Maynard Keynes wrote in 1933, the danger confronting us is the rapid depression of the standard of life of the European populations to a point that will mean actual starvation for some. Now, remember, right now you got 4 to 5 million Iraqi refugees. You've got 3 million Afghan refugees. There's over 1 million Libyan refugees. We now have somewhere between 2 and 4 million Syrian refugees. He went on, John Maynard Keynes, in 1933, talking about Germany, when nobody thought Germany represented a threat, said, quote, people will not always die quietly. For starvation, which brings to some lethargy and a helpless despair, drives other temperaments to the nervous instability of hysteria and to a mad despair, and these, in their distress, may overturn the remnants of organization. Those who sign this treaty, he's again talking about the Treaty of Versailles, John Maynard Keynes, this wasn't in 33 he wrote, it was back in the 20s as the treaty was being put together. Those who sign this treaty will sign the death sentence of many millions of German men, women, and children. It was just 3 months before FDR was sworn in as president that Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany. In February, he had burned down the Reichstag. Well, you know the whole story. I mean, I don't need to go through the whole thing. And now that cycle is being repeated in Europe. And you got the Golden Dawn. I read about this in the crash of 2016. Greek right-wing extremists forging close contacts in Germany in an attempt to strengthen their power base in Europe, according to German officials. I mean, this whole thing, these cycles of history. I never have been one of these people who say, oh, let's look at this graph, and oh, there's the Kondraki wave. That means that the stock market's going to go up 27 points next month. Let's invest in you know, whatever. I've never been a chartist. That's what these people call themselves, who think that they can invest and predict things based on. But that said, there are these macro cycles of economic disaster and war that you cannot deny. And I believe we are in one of those, in the down point of one of those cycles right now. And I think that this point in time is probably not that much different from the mid-1930s. Both with regard to Europe and with regard to the economy. I mean, FDR is putting things back together from 33 to 36. He cut unemployment almost in half. He cut it down to 15% from 30 some odd percent, more than in half. And then in 1937, when he was reelected, you know, the Republicans were screaming, oh, you got to quit borrowing all this money. And so he said, okay, we'll dial back a little bit. And boom, unemployment started going back up again. And meanwhile, Hitler's marshaling his forces for his invasion of Poland. I see striking parallels, which in part is why I wrote this book, but also, you know, because I just want to lay it all out. But also why I think it's so important that we say, let us not repeat those mistakes. Now, you could build an argument using the logic that I just shared with you, that had we bombed Hitler in 1938 or 39 when he invaded Poland, had we put a stop to him, the World War II would not have played out the way it did. It probably just would have been us and Tojo in Japan, and it might not have played out at all. And, you know, I don't have a crystal ball or a time machine. Might be right. Does that mean that we should intervene with Assad? Is he the good guy or the bad guy? Because right now he's the secularist who is fighting against the Al-Qaeda folks who want to create a Muslim theocracy in Syria, much like is happening now in Iraq and has already happened in Iran. When you can't tell the good guys from the bad guys, you got a problem.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sure, Assad is a terrible man. He's killed his own people. And the rebels cutting people's hearts out and eating them on television? Really? Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane among us. I genuinely believe I am taking a sane position in saying that when we involve ourselves in another nation's civil war, and there is not a clear American interest, and there are not clear sides that we can say, yeah, we really should side with this group, that we are doing something really stupid, or at least really dangerous. But I could be wrong, too. We will see how this all plays out. Nick in Suncook, New Hampshire. Hey, Nick, what's up? Nick, you are on the air. Okay, Nick is not on the air. Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm very well. Beautiful day here in Appalachia. And I have a comment and then just a question that lingers in my mind. Mm-hmm. The comment would be, if they're going to go forward with this military action, then concurrently they need to reinstate the draft.
Yep.
Seriously, our troops cannot handle this without it.
Yeah.
And, you know, in for a dime, in for a dollar. So let's do this and let's do it right. No exemptions for being a Harvard boy I don't want to call, you know, names. But anyway, let's
just
do it concurrently and do it right. And the other thing, I don't know if you know, but I'm trying to figure out if napalm is considered a chemical weapon, and it seems like it's not, and I don't...
There is some debate about that, but yes, we have bombs that are filled with what is essentially napalm that we have used. We have apparently used white phosphorus, which is banned. We're selling cluster bombs. We've apparently used them. We're using depleted uranium. We aggressively use depleted uranium. You have so covered the country of Iraq with depleted uranium as a result of our war efforts there during the Bush administration times, that they're having the most severe epidemic of serious birth defects of any nation on Earth right now. And we're running around yelling, we are the moral arbiters of the world, and we're going to enforce our moral judgment by dropping bombs on people.
When we opened the door as recently as Vietnam in dropping what I guess is not technically a chemical weapon, but...
Agent Orange it's not a poison gas for humans, but it certainly was a defoliant, and it turns out that it had enough dioxin in it that there's generations of Vietnamese who are suffering DNA damage, not to mention American soldiers who were exposed to Agent Orange and their children.
You got that right. I've got a friend over in Vietnam working for USAID who came out of the EPA to go work in Vietnam on the dioxin that still plagues them there. And that's just the point. There's a price to be paid for the wars that we wage that goes beyond even the dollars and the blood to the planet itself, where we drop these things and where we make these things.
So, in fact, I would like to say that I don't not only do I think that we should not be bombing any place in Syria, there is going to be collateral damage. There will be a response. We have no idea what that response is. What do we do if the response is that Bashar al-Assad decides to throw a bomb into the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, for example, or if he decides to throw a bomb into Tel Aviv? He is not without resources. Or what if the response is that Iran decides to form force? Or what if the response is an unofficial response like 9/11 was, where you get Hezbollah, blowing up the U.S. embassy in Beirut, or going, in a big way after Israel, and all of a sudden this is the World War One scenario. All of a sudden we are in, whether we like it or not, because we've got these treaties. So A, I would not only say we should not be doing this, but B, I would say that, months ago when we had this debate and the president and the current administration said, well, at the very least, we're going to give small arms, we're going to give, shoulder fired missiles and machine guns and bullets and things to the, quote, rebels. I think we should have said no at that point. You do not pour gasoline onto a fire.
That's right. That was a great song. You remember putting out fire with gasoline? It's totally insane, and it just flies in the face of what they're telling us. We're so broke, we're on our knees. We can't afford health care. We can't afford to take care of our elderly. We can't afford schools. We can't afford roads and bridges. But, hey, let's go stick our nose in someone else's civil war because we've got plenty of people to spare and money to burn, evidently.
Yeah, it's crazy. Devon, thank you very much for the call. Very well said. Sanchez in Long Beach, California. What's up?
A very gruvacious day to you, Senor Hartman.
Thank you.
gruvacious.
That's as in groovy. I don't think I've ever heard that word.
That's extremely groovy. Yes, sir.
That is very
right
cool.
There. I knew that you were right on the money. I knew you'd get that one. I wanted to add my 2 cents, with inflation, it's probably about a quarter of a penny now, but about this involvement in Syria. I think it does go beyond the examples that you were listing, and I would like to give you an expanded sort of geopolitical view of what is called the Islamic pipeline. First of all, are you familiar with that, Senor?
I'm assuming you're talking about the pipeline that has been proposed to run from the western oil fields of Iraq and, in some cases, the oil fields of Kurdistan and northern Iraq through Syria to the Mediterranean to provide oil to the Europeans, which has the Russian...
Actually, no. This is a different pipeline.
Tell me about
this. Is a natural gas pipeline. And
you're talking about the one that already exists?
Well, it was the one that was signed by the three major Shiite countries. Iran, the gas pipeline, this natural gas pipeline, begins in the natural gas fields of southern Iran. Okay. The pipe then goes through Iraq into Syria.
Yep.
And the point of it was that they would have this gas pipeline at that point extend under the Mediterranean Sea and feed through Greece so that it would send the natural gas on to energy-starved Europe at that point. This was coincidentally signed. I was getting information from the Tehran Times as to the signing of this major gas pipeline deal, as well as from other sources. And what they're telling me is that this pipeline deal was signed less than a week before the Syrian revolution began. And the reason that they call it the Shiite or the Islamic pipeline is because the other natural gas pipeline that runs from Egypt and runs through the coastline goes mostly through Sunni-dominated
territories.
And the the countries that are giving most to the rebels right now are the countries of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and
right.
those are Sunni dominant countries. So
right.
There's
let me add to this. I agree with you, and in fact, in my opinion, I could be wrong. I'm guessing that probably one of the reasons why Russia is opposed to this is that they've got a very good business going on selling oil and natural gas to Europe from the north, and this would present significant competition from the south, from the Mediterranean, number one. And which, you know, I don't know if that's turning into foreign policy or if that's just, you know, where the oligarchs are hanging out. I have no idea, no inside information. It's just a wild guess. And number two, and perhaps more importantly, if you look at the Guardian newspaper, and on August 21st, there was an article by Nafiz Ahmed titled, the headline basically, the headline and subhead says it all. The headline, Syrian intervention plan fueled by oil interests, not chemical weapon concern. And then the subtitle, massacres of civilians are being exploited for narrow geopolitical competition to control Mideast oil and gas pipelines. And
exactly.
this is what I was riffing about yesterday. If you simply look at the geography of the area, Syria for a long time has, you know, they basically ran out of oil that they could pump and export back in the late 80s, or they certainly reached peak oil. But as a pipeline, they are perfectly positioned to have on their eastern border Iraq and Iran, and on their western border the Mediterranean Sea. And I think you're right. And this is why, and again, because the Americans have a very clear interest in this, aligned with many of the Western European countries, and the Russians have a very clear interest in this, this could become a Vietnam-style proxy war very, very quickly, or perhaps a World War I-style proxy war, even worse. And that really concerns me. Jim, thank you for the call. Excuse me, Sanchez, thank you for the call. Jim, in Solway, Minnesota. We got a minute to the break. Jim, it's yours.
Hey, Tom, thanks a lot. I'm just calling to let you know that my congressman, Rick Nolan, is planning on voting against this military action, this military strike, and I plan on calling my congressman and thanking him for his courageous action, and I would like you to call your congressman and all the listeners to call their congressman, especially if they're voting against this military action, and thank them for their courageous stand. It's very important. They need to hear.
Well, whether you're opposed to it or in favor of it, and I recognize that there are some people who think that this is the right thing to do, and they do it from a place, I think some of them from a place of integrity. Whether you're opposed to it or in favor of it, now is the time to be calling both of your senators, unless like me, you live in, I live in D.C., I have no senators, or your member of the House of Representatives. We have Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is brilliant, but she cannot cast a binding vote. But still, I'm pretty sure I know where she stands on this. But you're right. It's now is the time to be calling Congress. If you go to callcongress.org, thank you, Jim, for the call. Go to callcongress.org. You'll get some 800 numbers you can use.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, of course, the White House comment line is 202-456-1111. You might want to let them know what you think. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve. Wanted to talk about a responsibility to people outside U.S. borders?
Well, I mean, I did, but you brought up so many interesting topics. And regarding the last caller, you really should be able to cue up the music from the old Twilight Zone series, you know. When
Armin called and said it's the Jewish bankers who are running the whole thing? Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, yeah.
And keep in mind, the Rothschild family supported a presidential candidate in this country. His name was John Huntsman. Just how well did that go?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, let's not let facts get in the way of, you know, our little theories. But
yeah.
In any case, I think you made a number of very good points. One, with regard to the link between World War One and World War Two, there are very many historians who consider that period between those two conflicts was merely a hiatus. And in fact, those are two conflicts that are conflated in many ways.
Yes.
And the failure to adequately resolve the issues at the end of World War One were exactly what laid the groundwork for World War Two.
Yes, and I would say that the Iraq and Afghanistan conflict, in fact, you could even dial it back and say that the Russian battle in Afghanistan with the rebel forces that we created, called Al-Qaeda, that we created, the Mujahideen, that we funded, Osama bin Laden, that we funded, that was the beginning point of all this stuff.
Yes, and another good point that you alluded to is this one, and I don't think that a great many Americans grasp this, that there are no really good choices in this part of the world, that we operate under some sort of delusion that if we overthrow a despot, that in that wake of that, we're going to all of a sudden see Sweden. And that's simply not the case. That, complex, developed democracies take centuries to come to fruition. And even we have our issues in our developed democracy, which we wrestle about and over every day. So this notion that somehow, tomorrow you're going to have this wonderful democracy in which people stand up for the rights and principles that
undermine. Yeah, this is the fantasy George W. Bush tried to sell us.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's simply not one that is going to happen overnight, yet we keep selling.
There's no historical basis for it. If anything, the opposite.
I would say that in terms of the question, we can have a debate as to whether or not limited strikes in Syria are going to be effective. Are they going to backfire and whatnot? I do find it a little bit troubling in that for those of us who consider ourselves progressives and consider ourselves to belong as much to a world community as to the United States in terms of being citizens here, that can we afford to say, well, they're not attacking us, but they are attacking my fellow man. And I think that's where we can fall short, because I do think that we do have a...
Well, this is why I said yesterday, and I'll continue to say it, that the money that we would spend on these weapons systems, we should instead be funneling into the United Nations to be setting up camps for these refugees, providing security in the camps for the refugees. If we are going to have any kind of military action, let's establish no-fly zones over the camps. Let's provide some security for those camps. One of the things that is going on, I mean, you've got refugee camps that have several million people in them right now in Jordan and in Turkey. And one of the things that's happening in those camps is that there's aggressive recruiting of young teenage boys by Al-Qaeda to go fight in Syria against Assad. And it's like there's just general chaos. We should be at the very let's create some schools in these camps. I mean, people, what's the old saying? Idle hands are the devil's plaything. Let's provide people with food security. Let's provide them with physical security, and let them, live out the civil war that they fled, at the very least.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a lot of really fertile ground here to tip it one way or the other. I was quite proud of the people of Egypt, though there is the unrest that exists there now. After having elected what was the only organized political power, really, the Muslim Brotherhood, in the wake of the overthrow, the people of Egypt turned around and said, no, we did not trade in one despot for another kind of the dictatorship and rule and oppression.
Right.
And I do think that that's the same thing that you'll find in Syria. Syria is not Saudi Arabia. It's not Iran. It's a very progressive, multicultural society. And I'm not as concerned as some people who think that we're going to get some sort of an equivalent of a Muslim Brotherhood.
Unless we do to Syria what we did to Baghdad and to Kabul, unless we bomb them back to the Stone Age, unless we so destroy their infrastructure that it's going to be generations before they even have clean water.
Absolutely, which is why, again, we get to the details, because, like, as it says so often, the devil is in the details. What kind of military action are we talking about? Limited strikes on extremely limited targets, not ones that destroy infrastructure and the capacity for a society to feed and clothe and house people. These are important distinctions, but, again, we need to be very cautious about exactly what
we're doing. On the military side, and I hate to quote Charles Krauthammer of all people, but, he said on Fox the other night, he said, Obama says this is a shot across the bow. Well, a shot across the bow, by definition, is a shot that missed. And now I totally disagree with him and all the neocons who say we need to go in there full war, World War II mode, all that kind of thing. But there should be no shot at all. We should be dealing with the humanitarian crisis. That would give us the moral high ground. And frankly, I think that we should be reaching out to Russia right now as an ally and saying, work with us here with the refugee crisis. And we should be, of course, doing everything we can in the UN to say, if there's a violation of United Nations rules that has to do with poison gas, then let's have the United Nations address this. But it's just, Steve, thanks for the call. I just have a minute here. I want to get Sarah in Anselmo, California. Sarah, thank you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. And as your last caller said, so many topics have come up since I phoned that I have to try and figure out, you know, where to go. But anyway, in reference to your thing about the 80-year cycles, which is roughly the length of a modern human lifetime, and like, as you were saying, you know, when the last soldier dies from the previous conflict, then we just start all over again because people just don't realize that, you know, since they haven't experienced it, did it ever happen?
Right.
And we repeat history, and we need to stop repeating history.
Yep.
History doesn't repeat itself. We make history repeat itself.
Yep.
And that's what we need to stop doing, and this is our opportunity to do that.
Yes. Very well said, sir. Very well said. And I completely agree. But it's going to take a lot of voices of rationality. And thank you for the call, by the way. It's going to take a lot of voices of rationality being heard very loudly here in the United States Congress, here in Washington, D.C., and in state halls, state houses around the country, and in city halls around the country. I mean, this is a time for local activism.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Trying to get my... for some reason, my earpiece is not working. Anyhow, Catherine, we're gonna get back to this conversation about Syria that we've been having over this last year. But there are a lot of other things happening in the United States, and some of them are meta to much larger trends. In fact, I started out, with my riff out of Crash of 2016 about cycles of depression and war, and there's also a large piece of that about cycles of basically oligarchy, of giant corporate dominance, as we saw during the Gilded Age, and as I think we're seeing again right now. One of the points that San Francisco has been making, and many cities, particularly those that depend heavily on tourism, but even many that don't, have been making over the last few decades, as Reagan's suspension in 1982 of the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act has led to a smaller and smaller number of very large businesses taking over local industry and particularly retail and service sector stuff and moving it, you know, into, so, you know, at the end of every night, every Walmart in America pushes a button and like a giant vacuum cleaner, all the money goes to Benton Rock or whatever it is, Benton, Arkansas. The results of a study done by the Civics Economics Group for the city of Austin, back when Waterloo Records and book people were threatened by a Borders setting up shop across the street from them, were striking. They say for every $100 spent at a chain store, a national chain store, approximately $13 remained in the local economy, largely through wages or rents. But for every $100 spent at a local business, $45 would recirculate locally, thanks to wages, corporate profits, locally owned oriented procurement, and potential future investing in the community. Now, looking at this, the city of San Francisco has said, you know, we're going to make it harder for chain stores to set up business in San Francisco. We're going to tilt the table in favor of locally owned businesses. At the national level, it may be less efficient, but we think it's better for our communities, and it's certainly better for the image of San Francisco to have locally owned businesses than to look just exactly like every other city in America. Catherine Mangu Ward is with us. She is the managing editor of Reason Magazine, the website reason.com. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. You are taking the side, if I understand this correctly, of these giant monopolistic corporations over the side of local communities, and I don't understand why you would do that. I thought that the libertarian perspective that's typically espoused by Reason Magazine was very, very strong on local control. Why shouldn't local people have control over the nature and economics of their own community?
You know, I'd actually say I'm taking the side of customers here. In particular, the idea that San Francisco gets to pick who gets to open up shop, who gets the benefits of the support of the Planning Commission, on the grounds that the local economy benefits, that there's more tax collected to benefit the government of San Francisco, among other things, I don't think that that's the correct standard. I think the standard should probably be where do people want to shop and what do they want to buy, not what's best for the San Francisco municipal government.
But you're not taking the position of the customers, because the customers are also the voters and residents of San Francisco. They elected these representatives. There is no major impeach the representatives who on the Planning Commission or the City Council. In fact, they're being supported in this. So you're taking the position of Walmart and McDonald's in opposition to the will of the customers. Because, as I said, the customers are the voters. San Francisco is a democracy.
Well, it's certainly true that San Francisco is a democracy. I guess I would disagree that democracies do a great job of perfectly translating the interests of customers through the apparatus of the state. If that were the case, then
what's the alternative?
We would also see on the national level, where we enjoy similar democratic processes, we wouldn't see huge amounts of corporate subsidies, which I think you and I can both agree are bad things. Just because people are legitimately elected representatives does not mean that they are also eligible to make consumer choices for the citizens.
Why not? If without digressing into a discussion of Citizens United or the doctrine of corporate personhood or something like that, which Ron Paul interestingly trounced on this show the other day, explicitly saying corporations are not people and should not have the right to participate in these processes. But nonetheless, if we can set that argument aside, again, what is wrong with a community? Why would you side with a large transnational corporation over a local community? I don't understand. What is libertarian about that, or objectivist about that, or reasonable? Wait, however you're defining your philosophy, how is it consistent with that?
The crucial difference here, as always, is who has the power of coercion. No one can make you walk into a Walmart and purchase something. But
That's not true.
Planning Commission of San Francisco is doing is saying, we absolutely refuse to let a Walmart open their doors here. They're saying, we will not allow it, and we will use police power or the power of the state to stop it.
Well, they're using the power of taxation.
It's not an equivalent act.
But the fact of the matter is that you can prevent people from walking into a Walmart, or on the other hand, you can prevent people from walking into locally owned businesses by allowing these large transnational corporations to wipe out all the locally owned businesses. And if there are no more locally owned businesses, the corporations have used the force of the marketplace to accomplish that. And I would say that's a force that's just as real as the force of government.
The existence of a Walmart or of a national chain doesn't prevent people from walking into a local store. It might incentivize them not to, because the prices are better at a big conglomerate. And again, that is a totally different thing than taking those choices away, than saying your only choice is to shop at a local store.
For every Walmart that opens, on average, about 114 local businesses over the first 5 years of the existence of that Walmart go out of business. That is a form of force. It's an economic form of force, and it's one based in competition. And you're correct. The big national chains are coming in with economies of scale there and purchasing out of China and whatnot. They're offering lower prices, and the smaller, local, less efficient businesses can't compete with that. But why shouldn't the community be able to say, you know, we're willing to put up with a few percentage points of inefficiency and higher prices in order to have 45% of the money that we spend stay in our local community instead of just 14%, and in order to have a local character to our businesses rather than a homogenous, bland, everything looks like Olive Garden and McDonald's?
you know, I think it's a totally legitimate position to say I would rather have a colorful local coffee shop than a Starbucks. And I think the best and most appropriate way to express that preference is to spend your own personal money at the colorful local coffee shop.
But what if that colorful local coffee shop doesn't exist because Starbucks was able to run them out of business?
That doesn't happen, though, through some magical power that Starbucks...
No, it happens, as I said, by the power of the marketplace. Starbucks has billions. The local business has a couple hundred thousand. How can they compete?
Well, for one thing, they do all the time. I have a Starbucks across the street from my office, and I have a charming coffee shop named Filter, manned by mustachioed hipsters right across the other way, and I go to Filter. That's, I think, what real customer choice looks like.
Okay. All right. Catherine Mangu Ward, Managing Editor of Reason Magazine, Reason.com. Thanks for coming on. It's an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
And a conversation I think, you know, more and more communities across America are going to start having as alternatives to the Reaganization of this country start becoming apparent. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, what hath Reagan wrought? Well, the Reagan Revolution hath wrought Walmart, McDonald's, and Starbucks. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And, you know, should communities be allowed to say no to companies that want to big companies? I think communities should have that power. I'm a big believer in democracy, and I realize that democracy and the wide-open marketplace are very often in conflict with each other, although most people who are advocates of a, quote, free market would rather you didn't know about that or would rather we didn't have that conversation. I'm not speaking to my last guest. I'm just, you know, in general, just saying. So anyway, Dana in Laconer, Washington. Hey, Dana, you wanted to talk about Syria?
Yeah, Tom. I'm a little nervous here, and I'm going to say something many will think is pretty blasphemous. They're talking about our American credibility as being one of the many reasons for going and attacking Syria.
Yes.
And I say, let's let our credibility take a hit. Let's tell the rest of the world they can't count on us anymore to always solve all the world problems at our taxpayers' expense, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And these other countries, so many of them, they spend their money on infrastructure and education and health care because they don't have to spend it for defending their own interests. They know we will spend our money doing that, and that's why we don't have health care and a decent education system.
Yeah. I'm totally with you, Dana. You look at the countries of the developed countries of the world, and instead of building an army that is larger than all of the, you know, or at least in terms of budgetary dollars, we spend more on our military than every other country in the world combined. And to do so, I mean, the other countries are looking at us going, these people are crazy. And then, of course, once you've got that, you know, we're back to Abraham Maslow. You know, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And you've got this giant military, and we've got to figure out how to use it. Oh, well, there's a little crisis in Syria. Well, let's throw some bombs in there. You know, if we had spent a half a trillion dollars every year building a national portable school system so that we could drop school buildings and teachers in by parachute to any city or county in the United States, and therefore by extension any country in the world, we would, and that was our hammer rather than the military, we would probably be saying, oh yeah, well, let's drop some schools in there. That might actually do some good. Dana, I think you make an excellent point. Thank you for calling and sharing it. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening to AM 950. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I want to say that, but this conversation is certainly going to sound like one. And I'm going back to yesterday and then today. And first, I'll tell you, I'm a talk radio junkie, but mostly on the liberal side of the aisle, not on the conservative. And I keep hearing these people calling in about these pipelines, the natural gas and the oil pipelines. And I realize they're there, but they're essentially no matter who they're talking to, whether it's an Ed Schultz or Stephanie Miller or anybody else, they're saying the same things. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I just can't help but think they are trying to plant a seed of something. I don't know what. I think you're the smartest guy, so I called you to see if you could figure out what that seed might be that they're trying to plant. And I say this in conjunction with the fact, and Mike Papantonio, who I love dearly, was talking about how we have to form a new party. And I'm starting to hear, again, on talk radio, talk of, I'm not going to vote Democrat, I'm not going to support this, I'm not going to, you know, the same thing I heard in 2009 and 2010 was devastating.
Yep.
And to me, I would rather try to push a Democrat than pull a Republican any day of the week.
Yeah, I agree. Well, first of all, to your latter point, I pointed this out on the radio, I believe it was yesterday, that in the run-up to the 2012 election, in the run-up to the 2010 election, in the run-up to the 2008 election, I mean, we've been doing this show since 2002 or 2003, and basically in the run-up to every election, I get these calls from people who say, I'm a Democrat, but I'm sick and tired. The Democrats don't have spine. They don't have this. They don't have that, whatever. I'm just going to sit this one out. And I know that these are Republicans, or these are people who are being paid by the Republicans to basically demoralize Democrats and encourage people not to go to the polls. I know that. And I call them out on it. And occasionally, actually, the demoralization has been so effective that the calls actually aren't paid shills. They're people who've been demoralized. They're just calling up to share that with us, right? And I try to point out to them that, you know, if you're not happy with the way that the Democratic Party is going, join it. Take it over. You know, show up, volunteer, become a precinct committee person and become part of the solution rather than the problem, to paraphrase the old cliche. So I can't speak for any other show, and frankly, because of the schedule I have, it's been a few years since I've been able to listen with any regularity or depth to any of my colleagues on the radio. So I just don't know what's going on their shows, nor would it be appropriate for me to comment, even if I was. But I can tell you on this show, when that happens, I try to call it out. With regard to the pipeline thing, the whole. That is a small piece of a much larger issue which overlays the entire Middle Eastern issue from Egypt all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, to Syria, and that is oil. This is an area, you know, that somehow God put our oil under their sand, right? I mean, that's been the principal operating philosophy of the United States and Europe, and, you know, since the end of World War I. When we broke up the Ottoman Empire and basically created these petrostates that had the dictators that were loyal to us. And when occasionally somebody would rise up against them, as happened in Iraq, we would install our own dictators like we did with Saddam Hussein. And so the pipeline stuff is just a little fragment of that. And you can't deny that there is a dimension of oil to this whole thing. And it's a significant one. But I think there's also a dimension of, you've got an industry in the United States, the military-industrial complex, that makes money off war. You've got politicians, people like John McCain, who love war, who think that it's glory, you know, that there's a great glory associated with it. And you got an election coming. It's a very complicated thing. Carol, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
All that said, I don't think that this Syria situation is about oil. I think, though, that a lot of the pushback we're getting has to do with it. Occupying the media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. Amazing. Food stamps, Congress can't get their act together. Debt ceiling, we're not sure what we're going to do. Housing and support, $1 trillion in student debt. It's just beyond Congress's ability. Go to war? Hey, yeah, we get all over that one. The Senate, was it the Foreign Relations Committee? I printed the thing out. Here it is, right here. Yeah, Senate Foreign Relations Committee, about an hour and a half ago, on a 10-7 vote, Republicans voting yes and no, Democrats voting yes and no, Ed Markey, the newest member of the committee, Democrat of Massachusetts, voted present. But Democrats who voted no included Tom Udall from New Mexico, Chris Murphy from Connecticut. Republicans who voted yes, John McCain of Arizona, Bob Corker of Tennessee, Jeff Flake of Arizona. Very interesting. But anyhow, the vote was 10-7 to pass to the Senate itself a resolution that, yep, let's go drop some bombs. Let's get into this thing. I don't get it. James in Sunderland, Mass. Listening to WHMP. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, you know, Tom, I was waiting for you to cover the U.S.'s support for the opposition of Assad for, you know, that's been going on since 2005 or 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been able to listen today. I don't get...
I mentioned earlier that I was opposed to our arming the rebels from the get-go, even with small weapons. I don't think that you can intervene in a civil war in a small way. You are either in or you're not. And when we inserted ourselves into that civil war, I think the line from providing, you know, a couple of cases of weapons to the largely Sunni rebels, in this case, many of whom are al-Qaeda or some of whom are al-Qaeda members, the line from that to this big debate that's being held in the U.S. Congress about whether we should drop 1,000-pound bombs on Syrian military installations is, in my opinion, a relatively straight line.
Yeah. Well, you know, and if you go back to news articles in 2006 and some of them in 2005, you can find articles like Syria and Bush's crosshairs from Time magazine. That's Googleable. It talks about the U.S. providing all kinds of support for, or certain kinds of support for anybody who was in political opposition to Assad at the time.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, there are other articles from Time magazine and then a WikiLeaks thing from 2011 saying that, you know, we were funding rebel groups and all kinds of, and anybody. So to what degree do you think this is like a problem reaction solution kind of thing, you know, for the U.S.? Or,
you know, I think this
is more culpable for what's going on in Syria.
Yeah. If you want a starting point for this, I would put it in the arguably the starting point was the breakup of the Ottoman Empire after World War I and our creation of these kind of petro-states. But a more recent starting point might well be, and it would be interesting to get somebody who's a scholar of this stuff on, because I'm not and don't pretend to be it, but I am fairly well informed. I think a modern-day starting point might well be 1998, when the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, wrote a letter to President Bill Clinton saying that we need to take down Iraq, to begin bombing Iraq immediately, to take out Saddam Hussein and put in a regime there that is under the rubric of democratically elected that is favorable to U.S. interests, Iraq sitting on the second largest supply of oil and the most profitable supply of oil in the world, and thus establishing a footprint in the Middle East and, you know, radiating out from that footprint, the country which is Iraq's western border is the eastern border of Syria. And the western border of Syria, of course, is the Mediterranean, which is the entryway into Europe. So, I think that the whole PNAC neocon philosophy that they're, you know, that God put our oil underneath their sand and therefore we need to basically control that region in every 16 ways to Sunday, in every way possible, politically, militarily, economically, we need to control that region. I think that that's where the seeds of this were planted, in that document that was signed by Jeb Bush and by Paul Wolfowitz and by Donald Rumsfeld and, you know, I don't remember the whole long list now, but by, you know, John Bolton, by a bunch of these guys whose names are not, you know, are more or less household words. Make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think that's where it began. James, thanks a lot for the call. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. A little while ago, you were speaking about the morality. Oh, by the way, as an aside, by the way, they got together to vote for Terry Schiavo in about 2.5 days, so they can do anything that they want to do real quickly.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you were talking about morality, and I was reading the poll yesterday, and the title of the poll was Americans Don't Want to Attack Syria but Could Support Limited Action That Did Not Risk American Lives. I translate that to mean that as a nation, we're willing to kill innocent people in other countries as long as no American lives are at risk.
Yes.
What's the morality of that?
It is fundamentally immoral. At the very least, amoral, but I would say fundamentally immoral. And I think that your translation is correct. And it's why I agree with Charlie Rangel. And Charlie and I have had at least a dozen conversations on this program going back to 2003, back to, you know, the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, about how it is time to have a national draft. And there are no exemptions for members of Congress, the children of members of Congress. And if everybody had some skin in the game, as it were, if every American family had somebody who was not necessarily in the military, but if any of our military misadventures were to blow up, would very quickly become a member of the military, then, frankly, I don't think Iraq would have ever happened. I don't think Afghanistan would have happened. I think if we had had a draft in place in 2002 when the Taliban in Afghanistan offered to give George W. Bush, or actually it was late 2001, I think it was December of 2001, they offered to give George W. Bush Osama bin Laden in exchange for his promise not to bomb Afghanistan if he would be taken to a third neutral country for trial, and Bush turned him down and said, no, I'd rather have a war. I don't think he would have been able to turn him down. From that point until today, we need to have a national draft. Everybody needs to have some involvement in this beyond just having an opinion and spending a little bit of their tax money, you know, largely unconsciously on this giant war machine. So, you know, yeah, I'm with you. I think it's well said, Bill. Tina in Jay, New York. Hey, Tina, you want to talk about Syria too?
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to bring briefly Israel into the conversation in the sense that Netanyahu is on a crusade to attack Iran and prevent them from getting the nuclear weapon, and the U.S.'s covert backing of Israel in that quest, because if we're in Syria and a mullah in Iran should sneeze, we're in Iran. And, okay, maybe we don't care. Maybe we're an amoral country.
Tina. You could say the same thing about Iraq. They both share borders with Iran.
And they bomb the Straits of Hormuz, though, and we're spending $30 a gallon of gasoline. That's one consideration of war in this area.
I don't entirely disagree, but let me respectfully disagree with your characterization. I don't think that Netanyahu or the hawks in Israel, and one of the good things is, at least in Israel, is that they're having a loud discussion about this that we don't have here, unfortunately. I don't think that they want to bomb Iran, you know, in the crude and bellicose way that John McCain envisions. I think that their concern is that Iran become a nuclear power that could represent a threat to them. That's a far more nuanced and in some ways, you know, a more pointed spear, but a more surgical spear than I think what you're characterizing.
What I'm characterizing is America's backdoor support of attacking Iran to stop it from getting a weapon.
Sure.
I was also curious about if there is an authorization for military action, does that change the conversation about the debt ceiling? Is that an automatic increase in the debt ceiling?
Well, that's an interesting question. I kind of doubt it. I'm seeing in the New York Times, they're reporting, by the way, which may have something to do with this, that John Boehner, after the next election in 2014, doesn't plan on being the Speaker of the House anymore. We'll see how this plays out, but I think that the Tea Party has taken down, you know, a new victim. That would be Boehner, and they're preparing to take down the victim of the United States. Presumably, this might set that off. You know, there's a lot of kind of conspiracy theories around this right now that Obama wants to do this. The right wingers are saying, oh, he wants to do this thing in Syria so that there's no conversation about Benghazi or the IRS scandal. I would say, you know, if there is a conspiracy like that, it might be so that we don't have a discussion about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. but you know, I'm willing to take him at his word that he's just horrified by the weapons of mass destruction being used. We'll have to see, Tina. We'll have to see how it's all played out. Thank you for the call. And Israel in the region, I mean, Israel is a is an ally of ours, and they are in the region, and they are at risk. And that's why I think they're treading very, very, very carefully right now. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Indeed. And you can drop into our live free chat room over at TomHartman.com. It's fun. It's free. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in on the news of the day with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. And here's Ellen wearing such a crystal heart. Hi, Ellen.
I am wearing a crystal heart. So the 10-7, the Senate voted to pass, this is a Senate committee,
right,
to pass the use of force. Interesting, Ed Markey from Massachusetts voted present.
Right, he was the only present vote on the committee.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, President Putin said today that military strikes without UN approval would be an aggression. He also said that he did not rule out supporting the UN Security Council authorizing force if it was proved beyond a doubt that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons. It's
yeah.
kind of an interesting.
Well, this
come,
was my, you know, my original take was Obama should have gotten together with Putin long before any of this stuff played out and said, okay, let's together, or your guy and my guy, go into Syria and figure out what the heck's going on here.
I don't know my exact count. I think that Warren Christopher visited 27 times, Baker something like 9 under Bush 41, and even under Bush 43, Colin Powell visited 3 times. This president has sent nobody, no Secretary of State, into Syria. And also he...
Or into
I
Russia,
mean,
you mean?
What?
Into Russia or into Syria? Into Syria.
In Syria.
Okay.
That's right. And also, I mean, to use a great Yiddish word, you know, they say Yiddish is a deliciously slanderous language.
Mm.
Well, the president schmied around, if I have to say so today, when he was asked about meeting with President Putin this week. And he basically said, well, we have a lot of things we've worked on. We've worked on the SALT treaties. We've worked on getting them into the WTO, World Trade Organization. We've worked on things like terrorism. But he would not say why he would not meet with President Putin.
Which has to do
mind.
With Ed Snowden? Is that it, or is it, or
no,
is it
mean,
now about
oh,
Syria?
Oh, I think it was about Syria. It was about Snowden. It was about there were 2 or 3 other things that the White House listed at some point. But I mean, you know, even when I interviewed Shimon Peres when he was prime minister, now he's president, he says, you know how he kind of mumbles, you must negotiate with your enemies. Hello. We're not playing kindergarten or junior high school.
Or seventh grade, to use John Stewart's
right.
phrase.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw his.
Exactly. Okay. I went to a fair amount of the hearing today. I didn't finish the last
25
minutes. You
don't have the Senate
minutes.
Relations Foreign
This was
Relations
a House.
Committee?
House
oh, okay.
Foreign
House.
Affairs.
Okay.
Senate Foreign Relations, House Foreign Affairs. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So Chairman Roy said the Assad regime would have to say what happens next. He says, are different scenarios accounted for in terms of us going in there? Then Secretary Hagel, who's our Secretary of Defense, said if Assad is prepared to use chemical weapons against his own people, we have to be concerned that terrorist groups like Hezbollah, just forces supporting the Assad regime, could acquire them. Then General Dempsey said, I cannot discount the risk of escalation. Interesting.
Yeah.
Also,
well, in a way, couldn't you say that this is an escalation of our original saying, we'll give some small weapons to the rebels? I mean, that was when we put our toe in this water.
Yes, that is when we put our toe in the water, and we shouldn't have put our toe in that water.
Yeah.
Also, it's interesting, on the chemical weapons treaty, the sort of re-up of it, not the original one in 1923, Israel and Myanmar are signatories but have not ratified it.
You're talking about the 1954 treaty?
Yeah, I'm talking about the more recent one that has just come Okay. No, no, I think there was one that the UN has sort of upped and whatever. It was just a few years ago. I don't have the exact year. Five other countries have failed to sign it. Syria, I'm embarrassed to say South Sudan, North Korea, Angola, and Egypt. And the USA and other countries, this is why it was a re-up, were supposed to start destroying the chemical weapons stockpile in the year 2012 and have not begun.
Oops.
So, you know, you got to decide. If you're going to play by the rules, you got to play by the rules, in my opinion.
Especially if you're threatening to hold other people to the rules with bombs on their heads.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you and I are obviously in the same place on this routine. Okay. Brad Sherman of California said today. It's at the congressional hearing. Said the resolution was obviously flawed. He wanted to add to the War Powers Act. And my particular hero, even though he's a Republican from the Human Rights Committee, he told me personally he's not going to vote for this no matter what. He has three questions. Clear proof that Assad himself ordered it.
Now, is this Brad Sherman you're talking about?
No, this is Chris Smith, Republican from New Jersey.
I'm sorry.
He said that Kosovo lasted way over in terms of what the military said it would. They said it was going to be a bombing thing, and it lasted 78 days. And he wants to have a war crimes tribunal for all sides.
Hmm.
Not just Assad, but for everybody involved. He wants to grant immunity and plea bargains to get the big guys. And he says that on human rights on this issue, the Obama administration has not been forceful enough.
So let's take it to The Hague and let us not forget the so-called rebels who we are arming and supporting, who are literally cutting out the beating heart of the opponent and eating it on television.
That's right. And he said he believes we should have a war, and he's got a bill in Congress. I mean, he'd be a great person to have on, because I like Chris Smith. Listen, I don't agree with him on a lot of social issues, but I think on human rights, I've seen his work in Africa. He will just stand up to the Republicans. He'll stand up to the Democrats. He doesn't care.
Wow.
He's a pretty amazing guy.
What part of California does he represent?
No, he's New Jersey.
Chris Smith, New Jersey.
Yeah. Okay. It's Brad Sherman that is California. Yeah. Also Elliot Engel from New York. He was very obviously pro the resolution. He said Iran is watching carefully. We have an ongoing humanitarian crisis. They are estimating 3 million refugees out of Syria by the end of the year.
Right. And why are we not aggressively dropping food and supplies and even, you know, instant schools into the region?
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to Russia, and I remember going there in 1978, and I went to a museum in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and they said, we remember the Americans dropping food. Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, good question. Good question. Ellen Ratner, you always have the best one, the best question. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great having you. We'll be back. We're going to have a very interesting debate here about chaplaincy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. We will be continuing our conversation of what's going on with U.S. Syrian policy. John McCain now doesn't support the resolution that just came out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee an hour and a half ago or so, because it doesn't go far enough. He wants to do some serious bombing. This limits us to Syria. It doesn't say, gee, we can go and bomb Iran, too. And so, anyhow. But there was just a 10-7 vote on this, with Ed Markey voting present, everybody else voting either yes or no. This was on both sides. This is turning out not so much to be a political issue as a, I think much like the NSA, you know, funding the NSA thing. I think that there are some members who are actually voting their conscience on this. It's fascinating. But there are other things happening in the world. One of them, which I find is particularly interesting, is that while churches can discriminate, a Catholic church, for example, can say, no, we're not going to marry you here if you're not Catholic, or even if you are, but you were divorced, we're not going to marry you. But businesses cannot discriminate. based on certain criteria. They can't discriminate based on color. They can't discriminate based on religion. They can't discriminate based on gender identity, on whether somebody's gay or not, basically. And so recently there was a photography shop that refused to do a shoot for a gay marriage, and they were sued and they lost the lawsuit because, hey, if you're in business, you've got to serve people. And chaplain and Dr. Gordon James Chaps Klingenschmidt, former Navy chaplain, defender of religious liberty, and fellow who runs the PrayInJesusName.org website, thinks that he has come up with a way around that commercial injunction that you not discriminate. Do I have that right, Doctor?
Well, thank you so much, Tom, and God bless you and God bless your viewers today. In Jesus' name, I'm happy to join you via Skype. I am familiar with the New Mexico Supreme Court ruling against Elaine and Jonathan Hegwenin, two Christian photographers that were fined and penalized for declining to participate in a homosexual wedding ceremony, which was against their religion. They have no problem taking photographs, but what they had a problem with was participating in the gay wedding ceremony, which was counter opposite to what the Bible teaches, that that is a sin, that God defines marriage and Jesus defines marriage in Matthew 19, is only valid between one man and one woman. And because they had a religious viewpoint and they didn't want to sin personally, they obeyed God and they disobeyed men. And for that, they were fined and punished by the New Mexico Supreme Court.
Yeah, no, and we're all familiar with this. I mean, those of us old enough to remember, you know, down in the South, the people operating the lunch counters saying that they should not have to serve people of color because that's the mark of Cain. And after all, the Bible tells you that you're supposed to drive people, you know, the descendants of Cain out from your midst. So black people are not welcome at this lunch counter. And the government came in and said, no, you can't discriminate based on that. And they said, oh, but this is my religion. In fact, the Mormons officially said, this is my religion, right up until 1987. And the government said, no, you can't do that. So you think you've figured out a way around this. Do I have this right that you're going to print some nasty words on the back of the pictures that you're going to take?
Well, let me just respond to what you just said. It's actually evangelical Christians who got rid of slavery in the 1800s here in America. Charles Finney led that movement. Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, of course. Martin Luther King was a Republican. And the people who wanted
No, he was not, for the record. Martin Luther King was not a Republican.
It is different than race. I campaigned for Alan Keyes for president. I support non-discrimination in cases of race. There's no reason, not even a Christian reason in the Bible that I can find, to discriminate against a person's race. But God himself discriminates against sexual immorality, which is a moral choice.
Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, respectfully, I don't think either one of us are going to get anywhere debating that right now. What I wanted to talk about, and I think you wanted to talk about, is that you think that you can get around the legal injunction against discrimination against gays by printing worthy of death or words to that effect on the back of the pictures of people in a gay marriage, that this is what photographers should do. Am I correctly understanding your position?
Just to clarify my position, there's actually two ways to get around this problem. I think the first way is to enforce the Constitution. The First Amendment of the Constitution forbids the establishment of religion or the...
No, I got all, but that's not going to happen. So to the pictures.
Right, but I think the Supreme Court in New Mexico is now establishing a theocracy, and you must be opposed to that, right? They're establishing homosexuality as the
government. So what do you want to print on the back of the pictures?
Well, I think a second way, if they refuse to participate and enforce the First Amendment, and they refuse to strike down that gay theocracy in New Mexico, the second way is for the Christians to go along with the law. Say, okay, we will take your photographs, we'll go to the gay weddings, we may even, as ordered by the law, we'll participate in the gay weddings by taking good photographs of you, the homosexual couple. And to exercise our freedom of the press, on the back of our business cards or on the back of the photographs themselves, we'll simply print the Bible verse from Romans chapter 1 and verse 32, that they who commit such acts are worthy of death.
So you want to print worthy of death in the back of the pictures. How would this be different from somebody who hates Jews, for example, or black people, you know, who have, or Christians for that matter, from hanging a sign in the front of their restaurant that says, former Navy chaplains are worthy of death. Underneath in smaller type, it says, all welcome here for lunch.
Well, it's different because race and religion are not to be discriminated against. The Bible doesn't punish those things, but sexual immorality is very clearly prohibited as a sin in the Bible, and it's a human choice that we make to contract with the devil. We don't hate the people. We hate the devil. There's a difference.
So
people, the devil rules, and we want to love them by helping them get free of the devil in their...
Okay, so, you know, yeah, I get it, that this is all about religion for you, and obviously very selectively. I'm assuming that you're not suggesting that people who are wearing clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric should not be, you know, should that their pictures should be marked worthy of death, or people who eat shellfish.
Yeah, people are often confused, and they say, oh, well, Leviticus talks about shellfish, and it talks dietary laws. But you've never read the Bible in Acts chapter 15.
Have read the Bible from cover to cover, from Genesis to Revelation four times.
Because that clearly says Christians in the New Testament are not bound by the Old Testament laws, except the ones against sexual morality. So sexual morality.
There is no prohibition against homosexuality in the New Testament.
Well, that's foolishness. Read 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 9. It says homosexuality and homosexuals will not inherit the kingdom of God.
No, it does not.
Acts chapter 15.
It does not.
Immorality is prohibited.
You are interpreting. You are not quoting.
No, I'm quoting the NASB version of 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 9. It says homosexuality. You need to read that version, NASB, which is the most accurately academic version trusted by scholars today. And also, repeatedly, Jesus.
Okay, so let's even say that you're right, and I'm asserting categorically that you're not. But let's say that you're right. Because of a Bronze Age religion, because of a 2,000-year-old religion, we're supposed to trash our brothers and sisters who are different from us, and we're supposed to put worthy of death on the back of their pictures. That seems to me not only despicable, but something that Jesus would find despicable. How can you call yourself a Christian and suggest that?
Chapter 17. Am I out of time here?
Yeah, well, I was going to give you the last word. Go for it.
I was going to say, Jesus said, if anyone offends a child, he should have a millstone hung around his neck and be thrown in the depths of the sea. So Jesus is against child molesters, and I think Jesus would support...
We're not talking about child molesters. We're talking about people who want to get married. Okay, Dr. Klingenschmidt, we're out of time. Thank you for being with us. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
His website is prayinjesusname.org. Dr. Klingenschmidt, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. God bless you in Jesus' name.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. We started the program. I was sharing with you how in my book coming out this October, The Crash of 2016, I was talking about these 80-year cycles and how the cycles of economic crashes are always followed so far by world wars. And it's one of the things that puts my teeth on edge, that has me very concerned, is that I believe that we are at the edge of a potential world war. And it has been the crash, just like the crash has been going on for a half a decade. I think the sliding into the war has been going on for at least that long and probably longer. And this concerns me tremendously. And I'm really pleased that the President of the United States said that he was not going to unilaterally commit an act of war, that he was going to ask Congress for the authority to do this. And I have to say, I think that when Mr. Putin today said that if you do this without the permission of the United Nations, you have committed a crime. You've violated the UN Charter. And I think that that's true. And also that President Putin said that he is willing to reconsider the Russian vote in the Security Council if somebody can please provide him with some proof that Bashar al-Assad had something to do with gassing his own people. So maybe there's some sane voices in the room. John McCain certainly isn't one of them. He's saying that the limited, you know, 90 days to bomb the bejesus out of these people, that's not enough for me. You wonder, what's the deal with John McCain? Is it like that he was so badly wounded psychologically, emotionally, by being a prisoner of war in Vietnam, that he has just wanted to have a war where he could kick somebody's butt during that, you know, that couple of years when he felt so powerless, that he wants to feel powerful enough that he, and he, his psychopathology is being played out on the world stage? I mean, it's war after war after war. When South Ossetia was having problems with Russia and Georgia, John McCain is running around going, "We're all Georgians now. Yes, Mr. Kashvili, he needs $1 billion. Well, we give him $1 billion, actually." And then, of course, Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran, bomb, 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 and it's on and on and on. This is dangerous stuff. We're talking about the lives of human beings. And other living things as well. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to the Sirius app. What's up?
Yes, I think that this is a prime example of where we need a hostage rescue operation, where we rescue Bashar al-Assad and either take him to The Hague or to Williamsburg and put him in the stocks and pelt him with genetically modified organisms.
That would be a lot better
way to do it than bombing children to, you know, save children.
Yeah, make him eat GMO corn chips.
No, you don't want to make him eat them. That would be terrible. Just help him with them.
I see.
Like a giant tomato the size of a pumpkin.
I'm with you on The Hague. I think that if our assertion is that the leader of this country has committed a war crime, that at the very least we should do what we have done with Mr. Bashir, the president of Sudan. We have indicted him in The Hague. You know, there's an open warrant for his arrest, and we could enforce that warrant if we wanted. And we've chosen not to. The League of African Nations has chosen not to. He's been running around, you know, free as a bird, but unfortunately. But we did indict him for what he did in Darfur and what he's continuing to do. And we should indict Mr. Assad as well, and go forward with it. I mean, if you want, you know, let's start holding people accountable. But let's start holding them accountable legally, not just, oh, gee, we don't like what you did. We think it's wrong, so we're going to blow up one of your airstrips, or we're going to blow up some of your planes. You know, it's like, come on, this is not a rational foreign policy. Steve, thank you for the call. Donald in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald, you wanted to talk about John Kerry?
Yes, hi Tom. You know, this whole business with Syria is just driving me nuts. I can't even sleep at night. And you know what really gets me is the way Kerry?
John Kerry, yes.
Kerry. Well, I remember I voted for him as a president because he made a comment one time that says, no way would he ever send our troops into harm's way unless there was a direct threat against the United States. That stayed in my mind. That's why I voted for him. And this guy's kind of like pushing it forward. And he's literally wordsmithing us into a war. He doesn't want to call it a war because, you know, the American people, you can't call it a war. You got to do something that doesn't sound like a war. But he forgets that when we were all getting drafted, if I recall, and if I'm wrong, correct me, before we got drafted, I remember them saying that this war was only in Vietnam was only going to last 6 months.
Yep.
It ended up 10 years, and it ended up 58,000 GIs were killed. And you know something?
And 2 million Vietnamese.
Robert McNamara, in one of his last interviews, he was crying. He was actually apologizing. I don't know if you ever seen that interview. He was actually weeping and breaking up. Apologizing to the American people, saying the war in Vietnam was wrong. It was a civil war. He admitted it. It was a civil war.
Right.
Well, for God's sake, this is a civil war, and here we go again. And John Kerry and Hagel, they should know better than this. We're not going to be able to stop this thing going. It's going to escalate from one thing to another, and it's just driving me nuts. And these people that think the Syrian children are more important than them, then you know something, they should start the damn draft and let them worry about it then, because, you know, this is what's going to happen. It's going to require a draft to be started. And instead of seeing 4,000 GIs get killed in 10 years, they're going to see 4,000 GIs get killed in one battle.
Yeah. Well, if we started the draft, I don't think that we would have the battles. I think if we had had a draft, we wouldn't have invaded Iraq. If we'd had a draft, we wouldn't have invaded Afghanistan. And this is where I'm with Charlie Rangel and have been all along. We should not only have a draft, but we should tie the draft to a national service program where you serve a year. You commit a year to your country when you graduate from high school or when you turn 18. You give a year to your country, whether it's in the military or whether it's volunteering in a hospital. And at the end of that year, you're eligible for a free college education.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or a trade school education, or whatever is appropriate, whatever is necessary, whatever your preference is. You give it to us, we'll give it to you. And, by the way, no one's exempt. The good, the bad, and the very, very polymicrianly ugly. The good. John Pepper, the CEO of the popular Boston burrito chain Boloco, told the Huffington Post on Tuesday that while his company already pays its workers more than the minimum wage, he wants to do even better. He wrote, "While we do pay above average wages versus many of our peers in our core market, we are positive that we can continue to build on these figures. A livable wage certainly is achievable in the not-so-distant future and is a goal we're working towards. We will not rest until that benchmark has been attained across the board." Well said. As Congress continues to put off raising the minimum wage, we need more CEOs like John Pepper to spread the news that it's possible to both run a successful business and pay your workers well at the same time. The bad. Senator John McCain. The Arizona senator is a big fan of bombing other countries and apparently a big fan of gambling. Washington Post photographer snapped a photograph of the 2008 Republican nominee for president playing poker during yesterday's Senate hearings on the Obama administration's plan to attack Syria. Yes, poker. McCain has tried to defend himself by saying that he sometimes gets a little bored during hearings, but let's be honest, that excuse isn't going to cut it. When you gamble with lives, like McCain is right now, by pushing for yet another war in the Middle East, you owe it to the American people to give Congress your full and undivided attention. And the very, very ugly, the New York City Police Department. The NYPD finds itself in yet another controversy in the wake of allegations that a group of officers assaulted two Muslim teenagers in the Bronx last week. The teenagers, 14-year-old Kalia Wilson and 13-year-old Lamas Chapman, were playing near their houses when officers approached them and asked for identification. The pair stayed silent, and according to statements they've given to the New York Daily News, were tackled by the cops who tore off their hijabs, a type of scarf worn by religious Muslim women, assaulting teenagers and violating their religious freedom. What a way to defend New York City. If these allegations are true, they are very, very ugly. Speaking of very, very ugly, and I'm talking behaviorally, the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of California, Melinda Haag, I'm assuming that's how it's pronounced. It's H-A-A-G. Maybe it's Haag. Appointed by President Obama. She's not a Bush leftover. She's an Obama appointee. And she's responsible for the area that includes San Francisco. Even though the Obama administration is now saying, you know, we're not going to go after Colorado and Washington State. They've decriminalized pot. We're going to, you know, let business be business or whatever. She is continuing to prosecute people in these areas, and she says she's not going to back down. She's got, you know, one of the people who's running a seemingly state-compliant dispensary. In other words, they're operating according to California state law. They're facing 40 years in prison because of this woman, because of this federal prosecutor. U.S. Attorney Melinda Haag, H-A-A-G. When I get off the air, I'm going to be calling 202-456-1111, the White House comment line, and suggesting to the White House that their federal prosecutor for the Northern District of California should be replaced. This is just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong. That said, Robert in Quemando, New Mexico. Hey, Robert, you wanted to talk about our pastor Klingenschmitt?
Yeah, and I'd like to say that on behalf of the human race, I bless you, and I love you, man.
Oh, thank you. I you know, at a certain point, I want to say to people who preach hate and use the Bible as its basis to not not inflict their God on me, because that's not my God. My God does not preach hate. But in any case, so is that what you wanted to say, Robert?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. James in Clear Lake, California. Hey, James, what's up?
I wanted to know what you think is the possibility, or what are the possible means, or whether the Obama administration will actually try to get Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so forth to stop sending weapons into Syria. And do you think that, you know, since we're going head-to-head with Russia on this, and China, you know, holds a lot of our debt and so forth, you know, whether we're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I mean, given, you know, what you're talking about with your book and everything, how much leverage do we really have here? How much choice do we have to not get involved with this?
Well, this is where I started in the first hour of the show today, talking about how I'm, you know, I've got a chapter in the book basically about, you know, these 80-year cycles repeating themselves and war repeating itself. And I'm very, very concerned that out of the economic disaster of Reaganomics and Bushonomics, that we're going to see a world war come out of this. And I think that the parallels are startling. I think that if you go back and you look, in fact, I was reading earlier from 1932 New York Times articles on these issues. And, I mean, there was very little indication in 1932 outside of John Maynard Keynes, who was writing about it aggressively, that the Treaty of Versailles was going to push Germany over the edge and lead, you know, to the birth of the political career of Adolf Hitler, and thus the Holocaust, the genocide, and World War II. And yet there were people who were warning about it at the time. And I think that and I'm also concerned, frankly, that World War II was just an extension of World War I, that it was the Treaty of Versailles coming out of World War I that set the stage for World War II in Europe, and that the stage setting for this conflict in Syria really could be tracked back to 1998, when the Project for a New American Century issued their document begging then-President Bill Clinton to bomb Iraq and establish a footprint in the heart of the Middle East, in the second oil richest nation in the world, to, according to Dick Cheney anyway, to you know, protect America's interests, because after all, God put our oil under their sand somehow. He must have made a mistake, right? And that document, that PNAC document calling for the bombing, that document that was signed by Paul Wolfowitz and Jeb Bush you know, the list goes on and on. That document is, in my opinion, the starting point for what may well be World War III. This whole idea that we need to just completely scramble the Middle East, and then somehow all the pieces are going to fall, you know, into place. And as, you know, the way that, you know, arguably the way that our Secretary of Defense was telling us would happen back, you know, with the war in Iraq. So, yeah, I think we've got a real serious problem, and I think that there are some real similarities to the times before World War II, James. Thanks for calling and raising the issue. Bob in Westfield, Mass. Hey, Bob, what's up? Thanks for listening to WHMP.
Hi, Tom. I was just wanted to say I was watching John Kerry this afternoon, and it was just like out of the Matrix, you know, limited strikes. This could be literally attacking Russia in the way that they may look at it, which could lead to nuclear war. But, you know, the main reason I called is I really believe that this is really, I've heard the pipelines, I've read about that. I think this is really about preserving the dollar as the world's reserve currency. That's what I believe this is really about. There's countries all over the world, Asia, they're abandoning the dollar. as far back as June.
How would bombing Syria do anything for or against the dollar?
Well, they operate outside the petrodollar system, as did Libya, as did Iraq, as does Iran. They're outside the dollar. It's about just imperialism. They've got to preserve the dollar. That's the only thing that's allowing us to have 700 military bases overseas.
But Syria's GDP is pretty inconsequential. I mean, does it matter whether they're operating outside the petrodollar system?
Yeah, I think it does. I think the dollar, it's a confidence game. To me, it's about confidence. What is backing the dollar? What backs the dollar? Confidence, that's it.
Yeah.
All the other countries, all the countries in Asia, they're abandoning the dollar. They're setting up their own deals outside the dollar with their own currencies. And they're backing them, and they're trying to back it with gold. They're buying gold hand over fist.
Yeah. Well, we're seeing that in India and China, although they've been dialing back somewhat lately. But that's a very interesting theory. Let me chew on that, Bob, before I offer some glib answer. I need to think about that. Thanks for calling and raising the topic. Larry in Nutley, New Jersey. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. I'm a bit frustrated every time I hear somebody saying that somehow the draft would be a solution to the war problem. I couldn't disagree more. I don't think that two wrongs are going to make a right.
Why is a draft a wrong?
A draft is a wrong because basically it's slavery. You have no choice of who your employer is. And your employer has complete control over what you're doing, including the complete control to tell you to do things that are illegal and immoral.
But if you're given the choice as part of a draft, like most of the developed countries of the world do, of either going into the military or going into nonprofit service, volunteering in schools or hospitals, what's wrong with that?
We've never had a draft like that in the United States.
No, but I think we should. I think that solves the problem, Larry. I realize it's still involuntary, but I think that solves the problem.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then I would add, in exchange for that, okay, you gave a year of service to your country, you get something back. You get 4 years of college or trade school. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And John in Oak Park, Illinois. Hey, John, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hello.
Hey, John, you're on the air.
Hello? Yes. Tom, my last name's Maya. I live in Oak Park. The point I wanted to bring up was this. You and I participated, like it or not, in a lie. In the 60s, I went to Nam. You stayed home, and you were right, and I established and went along with the lie. Your side was completely right. We went there totally on a lie. Nothing was done by anyone. Johnson got away free, Nixon got away free, and all the other people who lived at the Gulf of Tonkin didn't happen. Nixon called Saigon and cut him a deal. Once I get elected president, I'll cut you a better deal.
Yeah.
I've heard all of these things on your station. So yep. What I'm asking is this. Bottom line, why can't we put an addendum or something equivalent to it that says, if there is a lie, any way, shape, and or form. All of those people involved, everyone in the House and everyone in the Senate, because both sides vote for this, that both sides shall be held publicly accountable in court.
We already have that, John. And the problem is that it is up to the Justice Department, it's up to the administration to enforce those laws. And ever since Gerry Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, this precedent has been established of not holding previous administrations accountable. In fact, last week, pretty much under the radar, the Obama administration requested complete immunity for the senior officials of the Bush administration from any prosecutions for war crimes having to do with Iraq and Afghanistan. And I don't find it necessarily coincidental. It's certainly ironic that the Obama administration is asking for immunity against war crimes prosecutions for the Bush administration in the exact same week that the Obama administration is saying, oh, and by the way, we'd like to drop some bombs too. So, but we already have those laws. What we have to do is we have to elect elected officials who will enforce those laws. And that's where it has fallen down. It has fallen down at the level of, you know, the American people not demanding accountability. Because I'm with you. Nixon should have been behind bars. LBJ should have been behind bars. Reagan should have been behind bars, or the people in his administration, if he didn't know about it, when they cut the deal with the Iranians. Bonnie Sauter, President Bonnie Sauter of Iran, writing about that just in March of this year in the Christian Science Monitor. George W. Bush and his administration should be, you know, facing court-martial. I mean, if Chelsea Manning gets 35 years for revealing the crimes of the Bush administration, why are the criminals not being prosecuted? John, thank you for the call. David in Long Beach, California. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was calling about Syria, and, you know, what I was thinking is, why don't they go to the International Criminal Court and make this a true criminal action?
I agree.
Bring them up, indict the regime, and then go after them.
I agree.
Otherwise, we're going to have to wait for 10 years.
I absolutely agree. We did this with Bashir. We did this with the guy who's the head of Sudan, who, you know, because of the crimes that he committed in Darfur and in northern South Sudan, the crimes that I witnessed, Ellen Ratner and I went over there together and saw this. And he's under indictment by the International War Tribunal. And, you know, we did that to Slobodan Milosevic and his henchmen. And we should be doing that to Bashar al-Assad. There's just, you know, I'm totally with you. And that would give legitimacy to at least, you know, a Navy SEAL kidnap operation. Chris in Akron, Pennsylvania. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I love the show. Tried to get in touch with you yesterday, but got cut off at the end of the episode. But I have a prior Army service member, and I just want to address some things that you guys have been talking about and some of the viewers have been talking about. The paper tiger theory, people saying that the Middle East is going to see us as weaker if we don't go in and interfere with Syria.
Right.
I think that's a dangerous concept. I think you can't implement masculinity or egotism in warfare on the battlefield.
I agree.
It's just a very dangerous way.
Yeah, John Stewart pointed this out. He said basically we'll lose face if we don't stand up to bullies. What, are we in the seventh grade?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a childish way of thinking, and I don't really appreciate that perspective. Yeah. But as far as the draft goes, I agree. I think it would be a good idea, but here's the thing about how military contracts work. When you sign up for the military, you're signing up for an 8-year contract. And when you get out, whether you do, let's say, 3 years of active duty or 4 years of active duty, you're still on call. It's called individual ready reserve.
Right.
And if they did do anything like a draft, it would just be our service members going back into the fight where they where they tried to get out of.
Well, you could change that law, Chris. I mean, that could be part of the putting the draft into place would be to change the way that system cycles people through.
I honestly hope it happens because, you know, the term volunteer army gets thrown around a lot. And when you got people locked into a contract,
And a volunteer army is not a good thing because what it means is that you have an army that is relatively homogenous. You have people who are there for either the reason of, you know, they're gung-ho military or they just desperately needed a job. And you don't have that broad cross-section of America that should be represented in the military things are considered carefully, not just because, hey, it's my kid who might go, you know, a member of Congress saying that, but also the people within the military are going to have a diversity of opinions. I think, you know, having a diverse military is a good thing. And you look at the countries that have drafts, you look at Germany, you look at Israel, you look at their militaries, they're very effective and they're very well respected. And it's not, you know, as Thomas Jefferson said, he said, I hope I shall never see the day when in my country young men are willing to be shot at for a sixpence. And here we are. So, Chris, thank you for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. And up tomorrow, well, I'm sure Syria will continue in the news, but there is more. And we will be getting into that as we continue on. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to participate. Get out there, find a group that you're passionate about. Get active. Occupy something. Tag you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.